Our guest on this edition of the podcast is an eminent American. Shall we call him governmental intellectual? Shall we call him political scientist? Shall we call him philosopher? Those all fit for Harvey Mansfield of the Department of Government at Harvard University. And Harvey, I'm terribly interested in, and indeed you know I am because I called you about it, an article that you've just had published in the New Criterion titled Machiavelli's Enterprise. Has Machiavelli gone into business, as it were?
Gone into business?
Well, yeah. He's running an enterprise.
That's right. He certainly is. It's a business which is beyond business, which includes politics and non-politics, philosophy, nothing less than the world. I think he may have been the one who invented that expression, the world as a philosophical whole.
We all know what Machiavellianism, or rather we think we do, but in fact the difference between Machiavellianism, as commonly interpreted, and the complex arguments and advice that we have for Machiavelli is probably a fairly broad gap. All the same, let me put this question to you. Wasn't politics and the uses of power and the search for power and its maintenance, weren't all of those always essentially conducted in a Machiavellian fashion, long before Machiavelli gave his name to it?
Well, that's so. Machiavelli gave his name to a kind of politics which has always existed. That's I would agree to that. But what he did was to give it his license and his warrant, his approval, his encouragement, his urging to go a little bit further. You could say the natural targets or of Machiavelli's advice are people who are not above doing dirty tricks. But Machiavelli wants to prevent their having crises of conscience, which might arise from being guilty of dirty tricks. So, and that led him into what conscience might be, what soul might be, and whether there's any justification for a person who is pretty bad, but not altogether bad, to remain where he is and not attempt to go any further. So I think that was his chief contribution.
I must tell you about an encounter I had years ago that did indeed involve Machiavelli. G. Gordon Liddy of Watergate fame,
yes,
was just fairly recently out of federal prison and wrote a book, and he came on my radio program. This goes way back to, I should think, about 1975 or 76,
yeah,
when I was just starting to do a program. And Liddy said, well, yes, he was essentially a Machiavellian. He had read Machiavelli closely, and he did believe that what he did and what they did in Watergate was justified because politics is a dirty game, and you have to beat the other guy to the dirty play, and that's the way ultimately you advance what you take to be the good.
Yeah.
However, he said, be very clear. When I speak of being a Machiavellian, I'm not so much talking about, said he, the Machiavelli of the prince as the Machiavelli of the discourses. And that, indeed, is a distinction between the two Machiavellis that you yourself take quite rather seriously.
I do take it seriously, but in the end, I don't think one should find a chasm or abyss between the two. The prince gives advice to princes, and the discourses gives advice to republics, but actually you can find advice for each of them in both books. I would say that they're both connected to each other, but they approach the advice one could give about politics from the point of view of a prince and from the point of view of people.
What then is the basic advice that Machiavelli gives? What is the lesson of Machiavelli? Merely that the end justifies the means, or do we go further and deeper?
What he more precisely says is the end excuses the means.
Uh-huh.
So, and that suggests that you need a person to excuse. Who is it that excuses if it isn't ultimately God? God is the one who forgives us. And so if you're presuming to be a man like Machiavelli who excuses, aren't you taking over the office of God? That would give you a sense of the extent of his thinking.
There is a crucial phrase that you focus upon in the new article, in the new criterion. In Italian, it's verità effettuale, just simply defined as, or translated as, effectual truth. How is effectual truth different from mere truth?
Effectual truth is what comes out from fine words. Fine words used to justify or excuse or dissatisfy one's conscience are by themselves not only inadequate but ineffective, Machiavelli says. Those are what he calls a profession of good. If you pay attention to professions of good in politics or even in your daily life, you will come to grief, because people who profess good often don't do it. And if you are, if you trust them and believe that they will, and this is what the moral person normally does, he thinks that if I am good to you, you will be good back to me. So he performs first and he waits for the other fellow to be grateful and do some good back to him. If you wait for that, you will have a very long wait in most cases. And in the few cases that it doesn't happen, then yeah, you're just in the presence of a fellow dupe. And the two of you will be taken advantage of by the next person who is not good. So you have to anticipate that people will not be good in return for your good, and that your profession of good will be greeted with silence and disdain. So what you have to look at, as they say, not at people, at what people say, but what they do. And this, so the effectual truth of fine words is often and must be predictably supposed to be the reverse of what they say. So they will do something for their own advantage, and you will be left in the dust.
What name does one give to that view? Is it cynicism, or is it realism?
yeah, it's actually I would say you could say both, but with a kind of concealed moralism, because Machiavelli thinks that, and this would differ him from a cynic, he thinks that actual good can result from his way of thinking. And he promises.
We have that represented in a lot of adages that have persisted across the centuries. The one that comes immediately to mind, it's quite commonplace, is you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs.
Yes.
Which is to say, to get some good result in the end, you've got to do some messy stuff, maybe even some what appears to be evil to the uninformed observer.
Well, it is evil, then. Machiavelli would admit that it's evil, but it's still good to do evil.
That's, evil has its place, so to speak.
Yeah, that, right. That remark about breaking eggs to make omelets, I recall, was once said by Khrushchev. So it can be used by some very dirty characters.
Now, surely he wasn't really the first to strike the note of what we might well call realpolitik in the German term.
Yeah.
Realistic politics. If you go way back to Thucydides,
yeah,
as he analyzes the Athenians getting ready to kill the Miletians and warning them that unless they completely accord to Athenian purposes, they will be destroyed. And the people of Milos object, and the emissary from Athens says to them, your objection has no relevance. This is the real situation. We're going to kill you unless you obey. And in a way, goodness and morality has nothing to do with it. This is war.
And they are too frank, the Athenians. I think Machiavelli would criticize them for that.
Yes.
That is a very good example to compare with Machiavelli. Well, Machiavelli thinks that the prince, in order to succeed, must use fraud. Fraud is a kind of force, but it's absolutely necessary to use, because people who ought to live by necessity don't understand the necessity of living by necessity. So they don't understand that that the stronger will always win. And so you have to understand this yourself and anticipate that it will be necessary for you to fool them or present them with some fraudulent hope, usually taking the form of religion of one kind or another, in a universe in which the good will not be trampled on.
Now, he, in writing The Prince, he's actually working in a genre of which there are many earlier exemplars. A book of advice to rulers of Italian states or city-states are very often besieged by adjoining city-states. And so it has been said of critically of Machiavelli, the advice he gives may be good for the Medicis, and he's really writing this as much for the Medicis as anybody else. He served significantly in Florence between, while the Medicis were out of power for a number of years. When they came back, he was quickly pushed out, indeed tortured for a while, and then allowed to go off into the country to live a retired life and write whatever he wanted to write. He wrote all sorts of things, including a few plays. Mandragola is something I've actually seen performed once. But basically, The Prince and the Discourses on the first 10 books of Titus Livy are his best known and most lasting or influential works. Still, couldn't you argue that The Prince may suit the princes of Italian city-states in the Renaissance, but it has limited applicability. Certainly, it doesn't really apply, nor can one see Machiavellian activity in such modern republics with parliamentary or democratic systems.
Yes, it certainly seems that way. And a lot of people interpret Machiavelli that way, that he's he has advice that might be valuable for his own time, but it doesn't apply to us. I don't think that's really so. I think that...
do we see Machiavellianism rampant, say, in American government?
Of course you do. It's covered over more, and it doesn't appear in the same bold and frank statements that you find in Machiavelli. But you could say that our Constitution is Machiavellian, and that it takes account of conflicts, say, between parties that will not result in harmony or good, but will be fought out until one side wins or the other does, or both, somewhere in between, and that both parties will do their best to win their point, and neither will be devoted to the common good.
What do we see along those lines, to apply Machiavellian insight and analysis, what do we see along those lines in the current standoff in American government between the administration and its Republican adversaries? I'm talking to you. We are talking while the cessation of government, supposedly, still is in operation, though the president and leading Republicans from both houses are now in some sort of negotiation. And probably by the time this is played as a podcast for our Ricochet audience, that particular crisis will have been resolved. But consider the way that crisis has been played. Does one see Machiavellian elements there?
Surely, in the manipulation of the situation by both sides. Each side is trying to win, but presents itself as doing something perfectly obvious in goodness for the American people. So this kind of principled talk is the sort of thing that Machiavelli refers to as a profession of good in The Prince, and he would advise looking to the effectual truth, which is that both sides want to win over the other, but neither is in a position to admit it. So the consequence will be either a stalemate or a victory for one side or the other. And that victory is a matter of, as we say, spin or manipulation. So the measurement of force includes a measurement of the possibility of fraud.
There is at least one American president who dissociated himself from Machiavellianism in a public pronouncement, one that lives in my memory. I heard it and was impressed by the directness with which he said it. I have in mind, of all people, Jimmy Carter, who in his campaign, maybe in one major campaign speech, said, "There's one thing I will promise to all of you. I will never lie to you. If you elect me president, I will never lie to you." Did he keep that promise, do you think?
I'm not sure. I would have to work over my recollection to say yes or no. If he didn't lie, then that might have been one reason for his downfall. And if he did, then he lied.
Yes. That becomes something of a tautological paradox.
Yes, right. That's it's that to promise not to lie is assuming that you will behave foolishly in a future necessity when you might have to lie.
Still, he had a basis for wanting that to be a promise that he could keep, I should think. Unlike many other presidents, most of whom profess religiosity, he was and remains, indeed, a seriously fundamentalist Christian religious man.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, it seems to me, he's under certain moral constraints which impede full effective use of Machiavellian tactic.
Well, it isn't only Christianity that's against lying. But it doesn't seem, and this will be even according to Plato. Never mind, Jimmy Carter. It doesn't seem that it's possible to rule a people, or even to be a parent with children, without lying, without essentially misleading and misrepresenting the true situation, and it's often responsible to do so, because if you tell people sometimes how bad things are, you might so discourage them that that they wouldn't do what might be necessary to get out of that bad situation. So there are many good reasons for a ruler or a government to lie, but Machiavelli emphasizes the selfish or the self-promoting reasons for lying, because he wants to liberate people from too much conscience. And I think he might point to Jimmy Carter as an example of what happens.
What an interesting phrase, to liberate people, and you mean they're people empowered, people in political power, to liberate such people from too much conscience.
Yes.
If you look at our recent major figures in American politics, which ones were especially liberated from too much conscience, would you say?
I don't know, maybe Rahm Emanuel, or I'm trying to think of a Republican, possibly Karl Rove, so as to be nonpartisan here. The people who advise presidents are necessarily in a position where they have to tell him about his necessities and to overcome what may be his scruples. And I think that you can find in the general position of chief of staff or chief counselor, chief advisor.
Well, these are the people who advise their employer, so to speak, to go out there and lie. Yeah. Here's the lie you ought to tell.
Yeah.
But surely the employer, that is the president or the senator or the governor or the mayor or what have you, is equally complicit or more complicit because he agrees to do all of this. I've got to lie a lot, and here are the lies I'm going to use.
No, that's right. So, but he wants to make sure that they will work, and so that may trim his sales in the amount of boasting that he does. But either way, it doesn't seem that he can afford to be moved by his conscience. Conscience is precisely what tells you that you mustn't do what appears to you to be, at that moment, a necessary deed.
Is this a painful insight, first given to us perhaps by Thucydides, and certainly given to us by Machiavelli, and given to us by all sophisticates with regard to the nature of political process, down to the present moment and down to you? Is it really, in fact, a burdensome truth that we're dealing with?
It is. Burdensome and stinging. Conscience makes you tremble before you the deed, and stings you after the deed. But the difficulty is that conscience doesn't seem to be universal. That there do seem to be some people that are subject to it and others who aren't. And that takes you back to Machiavelli's distinction between those who are good and those and who live by a profession of good, which is conscience, and those who don't. And that's a mix of good and evil that forces the good to descend to the level of the evil.
Are there perhaps definable circumstances when that is more likely to be the case than at other times? That is, the good necessarily descends to evil. Is that perhaps a consequence of or associated with difficult times?
Yes.
Where there is conflict, whether within a nation, where there is burdensome economic difficulties and relapse, and or, of course, where there is conflict and danger and threat between different nations or different collectivities, so to speak. Is the abandonment of conscience an associate, necessarily associated with bad times?
Sure. It's associated with war, to use a short word.
Yeah.
So, it's in war that that you have to defeat and also to fool your enemies. War is a situation of friends and enemies, and that always that was thought to be the case, and that there was a certain times, say times of war or of domestic faction, when the rules of morality needed to be relaxed.
Goes back to the first treatises,
yeah. And then,
on wars. Sun Tzu essentially says deception is as much a weapon as is the actual weapons that kill people.
Of course, yes. So, but what Machiavelli did was to say that's the essential human situation, that you that you're always in a place where you've got enemies. People whom you have to suppose are enemies, maybe your best friend, see, but will your best friend betray you at some moment later on in your life, and when he's faced with a necessity of his own that forces him or compels him to betray you, so you could never say no for sure. That couldn't happen to you. Yeah. So that casts doubt over the friendship of your friends, and if you carry that kind of logic to its end, you you find Machiavelli's conclusion that essentially there are no friends and that everybody is by himself. Uno solo. That's the justification or excuse that he gives when Romulus kills his brother Remus. He had this. There was in Rome. There were two brothers, and one of them, Romulus, found his brother to be surplus. I don't need this brother. I'm not his keeper, and in fact, I'm going to get rid of him. And Machiavelli excuses that. So then, you're by yourself. I think that's the essential principle he's teaching everybody.
Well, Romulus and Remus are possibly mythical figures, but they are the founders of Rome. But in real modern history, we have rulers who kill many of their courtiers or many of their original colleagues.
Right.
Hitler, in the Night of the Long Knives, kills the top command, a few hundred men at least, maybe a few thousand, in the SA, the Sturmabteilung. Mm-hmm. In the Moscow purge trials and before and after, Stalin, apart from killing peasants by the millions and of various ethnicities, Stalin also kills leading Bolsheviks in the Moscow purge trials.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them even persuade themselves that he has every right to do so.
Yeah.
We have in Kessler's Darkness at Noon, I'm not sure who his model is, but it's one of the top Bolsheviks who confessed to being a spy for England or for the Nazis and went to his death. He's represented by Kessler as finding necessary political truth in the lies he tells about his own guilt under command.
Yeah. Well, look at President Obama in going from his first term to his second term.
What do we see there?
There's considerable turnover in his cabinet. Of course, he didn't kill the cabinet of his first term, but he replaced them one way or another. And this may well have been his desire to face the public with a fresh cabinet. All the people that work for him a certain fear that this might happen to them. And so they press harder to do what they hope will be pleasing to him. And you could say most generally that the difference between his first term cabinet and the second is that the second are people who are closer to him. His first term people, Robert Gates and Panetta and so on, were men of some more independent status. Obama has gone closer to, gone to people closer to him, more dependent on him, for his second-term cabinet. And that's a typical, you could say, Machiavellian drift or Machiavellian piece of advice to make people depend on you if you want them to be trustworthy. And of course, he didn't kill anybody, but then Machiavelli might say, well, he didn't need to. So it was enough simply to fire them or get rid of them or have them resign. So that is our time, or at least in our country, there aren't all these poisonings and assassinations that you get in the Italian Renaissance. But in a milder way, they're the same principles that are operative.
Well, and in near our time, as I've just been arguing, we've had a multitude of political murders done by the ruler, murders of former colleagues and friends. Stalin is certainly the ultimate case in point.
Yeah.
Here's some of the wisdom of Machiavelli. I'm quoting, politics have no relation to morals. It is better to be feared than loved if you cannot be both. If an injury has to be done to a man, it should be so severe that his vengeance need not be feared. That's a good argument for murder, or close to it.
It is.
It is double pleasure to deceive the deceiver. Mm. So Machiavellians are very often confronted by other Machiavellians, obviously.
Right.
A prince never lacks legitimate reasons to break his promise.
Yes, if you're confronted with a situation that where it's necessary to do some dirty deed, go ahead and do it, and then afterwards you'll think up a reason to defend it. I would question that first thing that you said, though, that politics has no relation to morals, according to Machiavelli. I think it very much has a relation, and that's because politics has to pretend to be moral, and especially to be religious. He makes a general identification of morality and religion. So the prince, he's careful to say, needs to be very aware that most people are religious and do believe in the conscience. So you can't be too bold or too frank in what you say.
Just as Thucydides, whom I keep comparing to him in some ways, says, unlike almost anyone who's written before him, the gods are of no relevance to any serious analysis of politics and the nations and relations between states and so on.
Yeah.
Forget the gods. He virtually says that's nonsense. We ought not to confuse ourselves with or by.
Yeah.
So we have in Machiavelli, don't we, pretty much, if only in his private correspondence, a rather direct, dismissal of Christianity as a vehicle to which one must relate intellectually or morally. Christianity obscures reality, he seems to be saying.
Right. I think he distinguishes in his audience princes who have a strong political sense of the truth of that remark about Christianity and peoples who still believe in Christianity.
Yeah. You play upon it.
Yeah. So,
rather reminds you of Gibbon, who someplace in a wonderful Gibbonian quotation talks about what the gods mean to magistrates and to others, but their utility is that they satisfy the common people.
Well, that's right, yes. Yeah, they convince the common people. Religion is the resort of someone who is weak. If you're weak, then you can't gain your security or gain your desire through strength or force. So
if Reinhold Niebuhr were in our conversation right now, mm-hmm. what would he say to what we both of us just said about religion and political power?
Well, he was a great one for a political understanding of politics, not too much infused with religion. And in this, one could say that he was perhaps distantly influenced by Machiavelli.
Ah, even though he was a figure, he was essentially a theologian.
Yes, he was. Yeah, but that, and Machiavelli was essentially a theologian when he said the opposite. You could say even if you believed in God, that the world often behaves as if there were no God.
In this very interesting article of yours in the current issue of New Criterion, its title again, Machiavelli's Enterprise, the subtitle, Machiavelli's Philosophical Musings on Truth Are Just as Important as His Work on Politics. In this article, you ultimately agree with the characterization that was given us a while ago by Leo Strauss,
mm-hmm.
Which is to say that, you take it from there. What's the Straussian view, and do you coincide with it?
Yes, I do. I'm a kind of follower of Leo Strauss, and I think that his book, Thoughts on Machiavelli, which came out in 1958, quite a while ago, is still the essential groundbreaking commentary on Machiavelli's thought. Strauss argued that Machiavelli's proposals to do evil should be taken seriously, and that one shouldn't simply dismiss the term Machiavellian as unfair to him, as most Machiavelli scholars do. It isn't enough to just say Machiavelli was Machiavellian because Machiavelli believed that being, or Machiavellian, doing dirty tricks would ultimately do humanity more good than the continuing belief in Christian conscience. So you would have to explain how evil can do good. And Strauss writes his book to do that.
You also say in this very article that Strauss was right. You echo Strauss in the thought that Machiavelli essentially is a key to modernity, that without Machiavelli, somehow we wouldn't be what we are and have what we have.
That's right. That or perhaps even more than the key, the founder of modernity, the first one who took the phrase modern world and made it come to be. He was the first to understand the world as worldly. Before him, people thought that the world was full of imperfection, and they believed in some invisible world, whether it was the world of Plato's Republic or the world of St. Augustine's City of God. And they believed in some sort of invisible world that made sense of the world that we live in. And that's and a lot of people still do today. They're not satisfied with the way things are, so there must be some picture in their minds of a better world. Well, Machiavelli says there is no better world. We must live in the world of what came to be called fact. And this fact, worldly fact, I think our word fact comes out of his word effectual. The fact or the deed or what is done must be our guide and not what ought to be done in some invisible, as people now say, pejoratively, some utopia. So Machiavelli began the attack on utopia as an essential feature of human life, and that's what he meant by, or what I meant by founding the modern world.
In the modern world, there are many outstanding problems. One that certainly properly occupies us and preoccupies us, and has done for some time, is terrorism. The 9/11 assault symbolizes it, but it's occurred in many, many ways. We have vast organizations within government and beyond government dedicated to the task of counterterrorism. What would a serious Machiavellian analysis suggest about how to do and how to fully achieve the ultimate purpose of counterterrorism?
First he would point out the need for counterterrorism, that is, the need for adopting some of the measures of the terrorists, and that is doing evil in order to do good. You must put them in terror, and I think it would highly approve of our drones that suddenly kill you from the sky as if some divine power, whom you can't see and don't expect, suddenly destroys you. So I think that the very notion of counter-terror is already Machiavellian. That you must make an impression on the enemy's mind, and think what it is that will do the most to discourage him, and so I think that's would be behind the American policy of concentrating on the leaders of the terrorists. So in other words, the people that the terrorists look up to as their leaders and as inspirers of their enterprise.
But the killing of Osama bin Laden seems to have intensified rather than diminished Islamic terrorism against the West.
Yeah, and that's the power of the invisible world. So they think that that they have good fortune waiting for them in the next world. So you have to either just attack them and kill them, or find some way to make them believe that their gods are weaker than our gods, and that means our principles. So when the terrorists say that they are stronger because they believe in death and we believe in life, that's a nice statement of their belief, and therefore they're willing to die and we aren't. So they are stronger than us, than we are. Because their principles are stronger. Their principles tell them that that there's something stronger or more satisfying than your own self-preservation. Ours do not. So that's the kind of weakness which the terrorists are attacking in Western principles. And Machiavelli would, I think, suggest that that idea or that criticism needs to be addressed.
It seems to me that if you think in these terms, as you do, you necessarily approach the very human condition and human situation with a sense that a certain amount of pessimism is absolutely required if you're going to go on managing it all.
Yes, you can only make men better if you suppose them to be rather bad. And because you can only make them better if you don't feel or don't find yourself under the delusion that men will be better because they want to be better, or have principles that will, according to which they'll be better. So
Do you think that is a delusion? Is that truly a delusion, or might one still hope and aspire to a time when the battle flag is furled and the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World, to quote Tennyson, and the war drums throb no longer?
No, I don't think we can look forward to a future without war. I would go that far with Machiavelli, but I think he's the one who believes that the world can be transformed. And
does he really? Where does he say that? And how does he say that?
He says right at the beginning of the discourses that he is going to bring work toward. He has a natural desire to work toward the common benefit of each. And the common benefit of each is to live in liberty and security. I don't think that far he's really any different from our principles. But he points out that liberty means the satisfaction of ambition, of the desire for glory, of certain types, outstanding types, ambitious types. And so that they must always have some theater of operation, and so there may be always some kind of war or conflict in human affairs. Otherwise, the ambitious people will be dissatisfied, and they will suffer from what he called, or what he found in Italy of his day, ozio ambizioso, or idle, ambitious idleness. There always needs to be some kind of conflict or war, but still it can be managed in such a way that a prince will gain glory from setting up a principality or founding a republic that would bring security and liberty for many people for most of the time.
A last question. We're almost out of time, but this does fascinate me. Some of my best friends are political scientists. It's a discipline I'm very interested in, though, of course, I'm a mere social psychologist. There is a kind of a continuing conflict or competition or disagreement within your discipline of political science these days between the so-called Realpolitik faction. I knew Hans Morgenthau rather well here at the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
I knew John Mearsheimer rather well, though lately I tend to stay away from him because of his very strong contribution to anti-Israel propaganda. But I also know other political scientists who say Realpolitik is a very limited version of the discipline, and ultimately proper theory of government and practice of government must be founded in overt and visible morality, even though it's hard to achieve. Isn't that a raging, if not conflict, at least continuing disagreement within the discipline of political science?
Yes, I suppose it is. I don't spend too much time with the discipline of political science, looking down on it somehow or somewhat. But yes, I.
That's why you guys at Harvard call it a Department of Government rather than political science.
I wish, but that isn't quite true. I have plenty of colleagues who believe in political science, believe me. So, but one could make the more general division or distinction between those who believe in peace and those who believe in nobility or principles, which need to be defended both in peace and in war, and people who don't believe that war is ever going to disappear from human life. So I think too that a lot of the people who are called realists and consider themselves realists are as much believers in international peace as those who make peace more of a direct principle. So so I think that today that most political scientists look forward to some really utopian condition in which Machiavellian principles won't be needed anymore.
Yes, I agree that many of them do. Therefore would necessarily disagree with people like Morgenthau, people like Mearsheimer, and probably with you as well.
Yeah, I think they would. And at the very end, I would like to say that I don't agree with Machiavelli. I don't think that that one should simply abandon one's principles just because they may bring you death or disgrace or whatever. I think there is still something powerful in the idea of nobility and of dying for a cause that is greater than your own.
In fact, that's a good form of or a good attribute of manliness, which is the title of a previous book of yours that we discussed some while ago.
Okay.
I thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I hope to do it again soon.
Thanks.
Bye-bye for now.
Right.